Good afternoon. I'm Bruce Wingus, president of the Akron Press Club and editor of the Beacon Journal and Ohio.com. Welcome to today's speech by Zach Space, Democratic candidate for Ohio Auditor. Just have a few things to share before we get started today. We have some more candidates coming our way here. After we hear from Zach today on March 19th, we have Frank LaRose, the Republican candidate for Secretary of State. Then following him on April 9th, we have Kathleen Clad, the Democratic candidate for Secretary of State. Looking toward the fall, we're working on dates to hear from those who represent us in the state in the U.S. Senate. We're trying to line up those dates. Also on our schedule, we have Eileen Shapiro, who will deliver her State of the County speech on August 30th this year, and that'll be over at the Knight Center. Details of these events as they become available can be found on our website, akronpressclub.org. And if you want to join the Press Club, please do. You'll have membership information there. Also like to thank each of you for coming out today. It's through your support that we can fund scholarships for young journalists and communication professionals. We couldn't do this without you. As is the tradition of the Press Club, there'll be time for questions following the speech. There's some white cards on your table. Just fill those out and somebody will be around to pick those up. And now, M.L. Schulze, a Press Club board member and WKSU reporter, will introduce our speaker today. Thank you.
Good afternoon, and I'll start by repeating, Bruce, thanks all for being here and being interested in what's happening in political life in Ohio and in our country. I'm introducing Zach Space, and many of you, especially Father Socrates, probably knows more about him than I do, but just to run through it real quickly, he's a graduate of Kenyon College, got his law degree from Ohio State, and went to work with his father in his law practice. As a consumer lawyer, a public defender, then Dover law director, and then he succeeded, well, the journalistic words begin with embattled, and then imprisoned Bob Ney in representing the 18th District. He served there from 2007 to 2011 when the Tea Party wave came in and Bob Gibbs took over the seat, which was then redistricted. And redistricting, I think, is a pretty key interest of Mr. Space. One little note, during the time he was in Congress, he got to be part of the Colbert Report's 435-part series on congressmen. And perhaps presciently, he was asked about his position on guns, the border, and Rosie O'Donnell versus this guy called Donald Trump. It is always interesting to me personally, the people who are running for not the marquee offices, the president, the governorship, because so many of these positions are so important to Ohio. And again, I thank all of you for caring about it enough to come up here or to come out here and to welcome Mr. Space and to ask him some tough questions, because that's what the Press Club does. So again, you have cards on your tables. Please write those questions out. And of course, we want to hear everything you have to say. And now I introduce Mr. Space.
Thank you, Schulze. I'm Zach Space, a candidate for auditor, and the first thing I want to do is urge all of you, actually implore all of you, not to search for the Colbert episode. Seriously, you won't find it. I want to thank the Akron Press Club for the invitation and opportunity to address you today. Forums such as this are a beacon of civil discourse, substantive political discussions, something that our country desperately needs right now. And it also serves as a powerful reminder of the enduring strength of the First Amendment and of a free and open press, both essential to a vibrant democracy. So just a word about my background. I worked as a small town lawyer for most of my career down in Dover, Ohio, in Tuscarawas County, just to the south of here. I fell into politics, really, when Bob Ney committed those mistakes which caused him to be embattled and then imprisoned. After leaving politics in 2010, the wake of the Tea Party movement, I left disillusioned and disappointed in the process. And I went back to work in the private sector after leaving Congress and thought that I was done with politics for the rest of my life. But then something happened to me. I came to the realization that our government was broken, and the reason for that is that our political process is broken. I have my father's sock, Socrates, that Schulze pointed out with me back there in the back. Dad, just wave to us. Can you wave? Yep, there's sock. Sock is with me often. He's 87 years old. He's a Korean War veteran, a proud Marine to this day. And I want to tell you a story about my dad. He grew up in an immigrant family in Dover. He was born on the cusp of the Great Depression, 1930, into a poor family in a depressed town during the Great Depression. And the story of my father wouldn't be complete without telling you a little bit about his father, my namesake. They called him Jack. He came from Greece, a small little island in the Aegean Sea. Beautiful place, really. He came over here as a young man and earned his citizenship in World War I, sworn in as an American citizen on an army base in France, and suffered a lifetime, endured a lifetime of hardship and poverty. He worked in coal mines and in steel mills the best he could. He was hampered by a disability occasion through his service in the war, where he was gassed. And he did what he could do to support this big, loving family under very difficult circumstances. And one day my father asked my grandfather, "Why would you leave this beautiful island in this beautiful place in the world to come over here, work in the coal mines?" Imagine what it was like to work in the coal mines in the 1920s. And endure this life of poverty. And my grandfather, we call him Papu, he answered. He came from, by the way, this island in the Aegean was under Ottoman control when he came over here. And the answer that he gave my father, "Why would you leave? Why did you do this? Why did you come here? You left your parents." He never saw his parents again when he left. His siblings. The answer was very brief. Two words. It was for you. See, my grandfather, like many of our forefathers, recognized something about this country that was special. He, like so many immigrants throughout the history of our great nation, people who came here sought opportunity. They sought to be a part of something bigger than themselves. My grandfather came here. He came to this country because he wanted to live in a place where every vote mattered because everyone mattered. And here we are, over 100 years later, and I think it's about time we have an honest conversation about what's happening to this democracy that has become a beacon for the world. I contend, and this is why I'm running, that that democracy has been compromised. It has been perverted by the influence of money and political greed. And allow me to elaborate. As a former member of Congress, I can speak with authority on this issue. To get to Congress and to stay in Congress, you have to raise a lot of money. Can't win without money. Money has become a central component of the political process in this country. In fact, maybe the most important component of the political process. And bad things happen in a democracy where money becomes so important to success. The first thing is, it's a colossal waste of your legislators or your president's time, or your governor, or your treasurer, or your secretary of state, or your attorney general, or your auditor. It's a colossal waste of our time. We should be governing, not calling strangers hours on end. That is a reality of this industry, the industry of politics. You have to spend time raising money, or you don't succeed, period. Number two, what's worse is that that money influences policy. It subjectifies what should be an objective process, and it impacts almost every member of Congress and almost every member of the General Assembly to some degree. It has no business being a factor in how policy is created, but it is. And third, and this is even worse, it gives people a reason not to believe in this democracy. So that when Donald Trump stands up in front of America and crows that the system is rigged, he's right. It is. Your auditor can't change campaign finance laws, but he or she can do something about this. If you look to Columbus, you don't have to look far to find examples of the influence of money in the creation of policy. Exhibit A is what's happened with ECOT, which is the poster child for corruption among for-profit charter schools in Ohio. This school has taken $1 billion away from public education, our tax money, shoveled hundreds of millions of dollars into private for-profit management companies, over which we as taxpayers have no right to see, produced abysmal results, graduation rates of less than 40%, average daily attendance rates of less than 30%, and enriching its founder to the point where he has a $1 million home in Columbus or Upper Arlington, a $500,000 condo in Columbus, a $400,000 lake home in Noble County, a $4 million mansion in Florida, all with our money, not our money, public school money. How does this happen? It happens because he happens to be one of the largest single contributors to the General Assembly in the state of Ohio. Your democracy is bought and paid for, and there are examples all around us. So whether it's for-profit charter schools, payday lenders, private prisons, the list goes on and on. It has to stop. The auditor could have and should have stopped the ECOT madness in its tracks by declaring those books unauditable when hundreds of millions of dollars were pumped into for-profit management companies without any oversight. The auditor can make a difference on this issue. The auditor can make a difference on another issue, another way that your democracy has been compromised. The sources of that compromise lie in political greed. And that manifests itself most pointedly every 10 years after the census when they get together to redraw congressional lines and state legislative district lines. So here you have a somewhat arcane constitutional provision that is designed simply to accommodate for the growing changing population in a representational democracy being turned into the most powerful of political weapons. The only consideration that has gone into how these lines have been drawn now for the last three census cycles is how can one party obtain partisan advantage over the other with utter disregard of the consequences, and the consequences are serious. We have seen the disenfranchisement of millions of Ohioans. When legislators pick their voters, voters are not picking their legislators. We have seen Ohio divided. This process empowers the extremes in both parties, and it renders the middle of the political spectrum chronically under or unrepresented. Because the only real political vulnerability that most members of both Congress and the General Assembly have, absent a wave year, is in their primary. If you're a Republican in one of these hyper-partisanized Republican districts, you are most vulnerable if someone gets to your right and beats you in a primary. Likewise, if you're one of those Democrats in those few Democratic districts that have, by definition, become hyper-partisanized, you too are only vulnerable in your primary if someone gets to your left. This causes both parties to move to the extremes, again, rendering the middle of the political spectrum, where most Ohioans find themselves, by the way, unrepresented. And it renders government dysfunctional. You don't have to look very far to find examples of that either. We can't even talk to each other because we're afraid of what it might mean to our bases. So here, too, we have a democracy compromised in a process which, once again, affords ample reason to the people of this state not to believe in the process. So when people lose faith in their democratic process, they naturally turn toward authoritarian figures. And we are seeing this. This has to stop. This, too, has to stop. The auditor sits on the redistricting commission. I will be at the table, if I'm elected, after the 2020 census. And I am a proud Democrat. My father taught me what it means to be a Democrat, but I will not be representing the Democratic Party at that table. Regardless of who's on that commission with me, I will do everything in my power to ensure as many competitive districts as possible. Doubling down on the mistakes of our past will not solve our problems. And finally, the auditor's office is relevant in another way that in the past has not been fully utilized, at least in my opinion. The performance audit powers of the office are such that the auditor can make meaningful reform and change in areas that matter. By way of example, think to yourself for just a moment, what's the most compelling problem that we as Ohioans face today? Think about that just for a moment to yourself. I'm wondering how many of you are thinking about what I'm thinking about, and that is this opioid scourge that is wracking our communities. Whatever it is the state of Ohio is doing to help solve this problem is not working. We are spending hundreds of millions of dollars. 17,000 Ohioans have died from opioid overdoses since 2010. That number continues to increase exponentially. I intend to use the performance powers of this office to audit Medicaid, specifically with respect to what it's doing, what it's spending, what resources we're using to combat this problem, and assess and measure what's effective and what's not, which will be the first step in the creation of a comprehensive plan to deal with this crisis. In fact, every constitutional office should be bringing the full powers of their offices to bear in dealing with this problem. So, as a proud Democrat, I am a believer in the concept that many of us refer to as social justice. And as I think of that term, I think of things like justice when it comes to access to public education, justice when it comes to access to quality health care, opportunity, racial justice, gender justice, all these things that we strive for. None of it happens none of it until we obtain a form of political justice that restores those basic and fundamental principles of democracy that people like my grandfather risked everything for. Now is the time to reclaim this democracy, and this is why I'm running. So I know that was a very general 30,000 foot perspective, and I am eager to try to answer some of your more granular questions you may have now.
While folks are picking up the cards through the audience, somebody stopped by and actually dropped off a question for you.
Hey.
and a lot of preface and a lot of documents, I'll give them to you. Should the state auditor, and how should the state auditor, evaluate statewide responsibilities for reporting to the background check database on guns and make recommendations for improvements and consistent monitoring?
Okay, and just a real quick preface in my response to that question. First of all, I am a gun owner, and I have been for many years, and I come from a culture where responsible gun ownership is common and valued. But I also understand the importance and need to place reasonable restrictions on access to dangerous firearms. And to the extent that it matters to those in the audience, I believe there is a balance to be arrived at here. In answer to the question, the first thing that comes to my mind is, what entity would be subject to the audit? And I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. The second issue has to do with how are state revenues associated with this and whether that would give the auditor jurisdiction to do a comprehensive audit on background checks. Open to the idea, and I don't mean to be evasive or indirect, but as I see it, I'm not sure there's a role for the state auditor in that regard. It's not to say it's not important, it is. And I'm happy to consider different perspectives, but I just don't see the direct correlation to the duties of the office.
Okay. What are your feelings about the redistricting issue that is going to be on the May ballot? What are its strengths? What are its holes?
Okay, so based on my remarks, you might guess that I'd like to see the complete and utter depoliticization of the process of redistricting, and you'd be correct in that guess. So my sense is it doesn't go far enough in taking the politics out, but it is a step in the right direction, and it represents a compromise that I think in large part was induced by the hard work of hundreds, if not thousands, of petition gatherers who and the leverage that brought, but a compromise nonetheless. And we got to practice what we preach. And I think compromise, I preach the need for compromise. So it's hard for me to stand up here and say it's not a good plan. I'm going to vote for it, and I support it and encourage everyone here to consider voting for it as well. I think it represents a step in the right direction.
At least partially related, should the position of state auditor be a partisan position? And does partisan politics factor into the office?
Well, it's a constitutional office, and it would require a constitutional amendment to change that. And the alternative to an elected partisan position would likely be a gubernatorial appointment, as they do in some states. So I think it's not a perfect world, but it's very much like judges. There are questions about whether judges should be elected as well. Bottom line is, I think it's the auditor's unique in terms of the responsibility that position has to the people of Ohio. It answers to the people of the state of Ohio. I have committed time and again to maintaining an objective, nonpartisan position, particularly when it comes to issues associated with gerrymandering. You heard what I said earlier. I think that same logic extends to the auditing powers associated with state agencies and anybody that receives state money. It should not be exercised in a partisan fashion, but I just don't see any alternative to the partisan elections that we have absent a constitutional change.
What can you do as auditor to help empower low-income families with financial stability, for example, about payday loans?
So you heard me reference payday lending in my talk. I think payday lending is a pretty clear, when I say payday lending, the process associated with how this General Assembly has regulated that industry is a clear example of what's wrong with politics in Columbus. The industry itself has paid millions of dollars to members of the General Assembly, and it shows. The results are clear. Ohio's payday lending statutes are some of the loosest in the country. You can pay up to almost 500% annual interest. You get caught up, especially those of limited financial means, get caught up in these things, and it becomes an endless cycle. And it is not just an example of the way that politics influences policy, or money influences policy, but it's an example of the fact that nothing is off limits. Nothing is sacred. Not the poor, not your children. Nothing is off limits when it comes to the influence of money in politics. So the first part of that question entailed a lot of different components. What do you do about people who are financially challenged as auditor? The second part deals with a much more specific issue. What I hope to do, and this is different, I want to shine a light on that process associated with pay for play. I want to figure out a way to use these powers dynamically and creatively to make sure that these legislators know somebody's watching. Right now, nobody's watching. And I want to change that. And I think generally speaking, with respect to the first part of your question, when we pass laws that are objective and well-intentioned, all of us benefit, especially the poor.
Follow up with specifics on the payday lenders. If the legislature doesn't change the law, is there something under the current structure that the auditor can and should do?
Again, the answer is no. The auditor doesn't have lawmaking authority, but what the auditor can do is use the powers of his or her office as a soapbox. And I intend to do that to rail against a process which is inherently unfair to most Ohioans.
Will you audit Jobs Ohio and discuss the merits behind auditing private companies that are contracted by the state?
By statute, the auditor is not allowed to audit Jobs Ohio, which I think is preposterous. Again, about $1 billion a year. These are taxpayer monies, revenues off of liquor sales that go into Jobs Ohio. And they may be doing a great job with that money, but we don't know. The legislature passed a law that says the auditor can't open the books and do a comprehensive audit. I can't change that law, but I intend to try to raise public awareness about the need to change it and use the office in that capacity. And the second part of the question, if I understand it correctly, look, these are taxpayer dollars that are going to public entities. There are many cases and examples where that makes good sense. But I'm all about trying to increase transparency, and it is vital. Not that just that the auditor is taking a look at these monies to make sure that they're being spent in accordance with law and accordance with sound accounting principles, but the people of Ohio have an advocate who's looking out for them as well. So, I think there's merit in it, and I will continue to do it robustly and aggressively.
Please tell us how you can use the power of the office to curb greenhouse gas emissions and enforce environmental protections.
Okay, so this is interesting. I want you to kind of follow me on this one. So I'm a coal country Democrat that voted for cap and trade, which is one, probably not the only reason, but one of the reasons I'm no longer in Congress. So I believe in climate change and the perils associated with global warming and the need for us to do something about it, because in large part, if not primarily, it's anthropogenic. Let me do it in reverse order here. Think about this for a moment. The state of Ohio, several years ago, had a burgeoning, robust wind energy business. We had wind energy companies from around the world looking at Ohio, making plans in Ohio, putting money into developments in Ohio. And one state senator managed to put an amendment into a bill 3 years ago under cover of darkness, without a hearing, that more than doubled the wind setback requirements, meaning you couldn't build these things any closer than a certain amount of feet from somebody else's property line. And that effectively killed the wind industry in Ohio in its tracks. We have lost over $4 billion in provable investments as a result of that one amendment. $4 billion. This is in direct investments. This doesn't include indirect or ancillary investments associated with companies like Google or Apple or Microsoft that won't come to a state if they don't have enough advanced energy capacity. Likewise, the legislature, in its infinite wisdom, chose to freeze the renewable portfolio standards a few years ago, and now is on the verge of repealing them altogether. These were designed to push out the technology associated with advanced energy, solar and wind, designed to push out investments in Ohio. The legislature froze those standards and again, doesn't appear to be inclined to thaw them out. This, too, has caused the state of Ohio enormous amounts in terms of investments and jobs. I think there's a role for the auditor here. So I don't know if I believe me, this is something I've been looking at now for months, trying to figure out a way to use the powers of this office to shine a light on what we're losing by being so regressive in our policies. One way may be to get it from the ground up. Work with some of the local school districts that have lost millions of dollars in revenues as a result of these regressive measures. I'm not here to tell you all the details yet. I'm still working them out, but I am here to tell you this is a priority for me, and I intend to exercise the powers of this office in a creative way to try, if nothing else, to shine a light on the injustice associated with these regressive policies.
We got a lot of people who believe in the power of this auditor's office, because now you're asked to tell us what the auditor can do to fight repeated killings of black men by police.
You're testing my ability to stretch the confines of this office to cover all these. And I don't mean to belittle it. Obviously, Black Lives Matter is an important movement, and you know, any form of intolerance and oppression is wrong. I don't have an answer for that, other than to say this. You know, I am committed to moving the needle on the issue associated with the influence of money and the creation of policy. And when that happens, when we get to a society that is basing its decisions purely and solely on what's best for everybody, I think we all experience a measure of justice. So to the extent that our legislature acts more rationally, our constitutional offices act more rationally, as opposed to subjectively with consideration of monetary campaign contributions, issues like that will be, they're not going to be resolved, but it'll be movement in the right direction on issues like that.
This is back to the issue of guns. You co-sponsored the National Reciprocity Act with Representative Steve King of Iowa. Do you still support reciprocity?
And so let me just have a kind of a candid conversation about the gun issue again. The gun issue is a dilemma for a lot of reasons. Not the least of which is the important and integral piece of culture in certain parts of our state, in certain parts of our country. In my family, everybody owns a gun. I mean, there are shotguns, there are handguns, and everybody's responsible in how they own that gun. And it's important for the families of Appalachia, the hunters, the target shooters, the collectors. And on the other side of this equation are these devastatingly tragic events that keep happening over and over and over again. And we live in a culture that seems to, it wants everything to be black and white. But nothing's ever black and white. Everything's always gray. I think things like reciprocity, my thinking about guns has changed over the years. I'm no longer an NRA member. I stopped that after Gabby Giffords was brutally shot down in Arizona, a former colleague of mine. I don't ascribe to the NRA's positions on every issue. I'm not here to pick a fight with the NRA because I am a responsible gun owner. I think things like closing the gun show loophole, imposing vigorous and extensive, and then enforcing vigorous and extensive background checks are necessary. And I question now my support for the reciprocity as well. But you fall into traps in the business of politics because, like I said, we live in a time and in a culture, and it doesn't just apply to politics, where the mentality is you're either with me or you're against me. Well, we can be with each other and against each other. And what I hope that this campaign, and if I'm blessed enough to win, what my tenure as the next state auditor will be, is an opportunity to help try to mend these fences and bring us together. So in direct answer to the question, no, I don't. But it's a much more nuanced response that would be appropriate in connection with that question. And it applies not just to guns, but virtually every issue we see day in, day out. Again, my father's name is Socrates. I'm a proud Greek. I studied classical Greek in college, and I understand, you know, the teachings of Aristotle when he espoused the virtue of moderation. We seem to have lost that in this country. And I hope that I can bring some common sense moderation back to government.
The rollout of Ohio's marijuana program has been plagued with some problems. The current auditor has gotten involved in that. What do you see yourself doing if you were auditor?
Well, first of all, with respect to Auditor Yost's involvement, and I don't fault him for that. I mean, it appears as though this process has been sloppy, and the process being following the rules of the legislature and the regulations that ensued concerning how this medical marijuana apparatus would be established. So auditing what appear to be obvious errors in process would seem appropriate to me. So I'm not here to fault Dave Yost at all, but to a large degree, what the auditor's office does is establish priorities. And I can tell you this, the legislature passed a law that the governor signed allowing for medical marijuana. Any of us who has a family member who have one of those listed conditions, maybe not all of us feel this way, but I certainly feel as though if this is going to give my loved one a chance at a better, improved quality of life, then I'm all for it. I think any efforts to stall the implementation of this law under the pretext of an audit would be a mistake and an injustice.
Tonight, Governor Kasich gives his final State of the State speech. What do you want to hear in that?
Well, I'd like to hear him enthusiastically embrace the Zacks-based agenda when it comes to campaign finance reform and redistricting reform, I don't expect that. Here's what I'd like to hear from him. I know that the numbers are all coming in terms of where we are as a state, what the unemployment rate is, the new jobs, the new capital investments, all the things that go into a calculation as to how we measure progress, how we measure economic progress. And I know that the governor is going to tout those things that would suggest that things are going really well in Ohio. Here's what I'd like for him to do. I'd like for him to be honest with Ohioans. We have done some things well. He's done some things well. But there are things that he has not done well, and there are things this General Assembly have not done well. And the one thing they haven't done is they haven't worried about the bottom half. Millions of Ohioans live and work full-time in poverty. That is unacceptable. What is he doing about that? What is the General Assembly doing about lifting people out of poverty beyond words? People who are working full-time jobs and supporting families. What is he doing about the wages in Ohio? Real wages. That I'd like to know. I'd like to hear him make a commitment to the bottom half as opposed to the top 1%.
Is the state Democratic Party in better shape today than it was in 2016?
I'd say it couldn't be any worse, right? Answer is yes. So, yes, the party itself, I think, is in good hands, and I think David Pepper has done a good job in terms of his organizational, administrative skills. He's rolling out good messages, and it would appear that we as a party have the wind at our backs. I'm not going to speculate as to why, but you all probably have a pretty good idea as to why. I think from a historical perspective, the first off year with a new president, the other party picks up seats. So I think history tells us and the reality of what's happening in Washington tell us that this may be a really good year, but I think it is a huge mistake for Democrats to count on that. We need to work, and we need to engage, and we need to make sure that any victories that we attain this year are made sustainable and lasting, and the only way to do that is to connect in a real way with the people of this state who have been forgotten by this process. I'm not going to belabor this too much longer, but the people where I'm from, Tuscarawas County, and the counties that I represented in Congress, almost all of which were Appalachian counties, they feel left behind. They feel as though they have been forgotten by this political process. And I am committed as a candidate, not just to spending time in these counties that have been left behind, in engaging these voters, but encouraging other Democrats to do so as well. And I'm happy to say that David Pepper has acknowledged this. The party is spending more time in Appalachia. And I see that as a very, very positive sign.
And then lastly, returning to the specifics of the auditor's office, what are your top priorities for that office?
Okay, so I'm not gonna repeat my speech, but my top priorities are, I'll tell you my very, very top priority. And then you can conclude what you will from that. When I told you in my speech that I was essentially called back to office, I mean, I felt the need to do this because of an utter belief, a total belief that our process is broken. And it's the broken process is one thing, but it's the consequences of a broken process, they're quite another. We need to do something to restore confidence and faith in the institution of politics, in the institution of government, in the very institution of democracy. And none of us can do this alone. All of us, however, can do this together. So I've got this great quote, and I'll end on this. Nathan on my staff offered me this. I hope I'm not attributing this to the right person. This is from Abraham Joshua Heschel, who was a famous rabbi and active in the civil rights movement. And he said, "In a free society, some are guilty, but all are responsible." And my point in making that, in bringing that quote that Nathan brought to my attention up, is that, you know, there are some who are guilty of making our politics divisive and structured in such a way that it's not, our politics are not serving the needs of our community. But every one of us has a responsibility to be a part of the problem. Every one of us has a responsibility to take our highest and best abilities to fix this. This is how I feel. So my top responsibility, my most important goal is I want to the extent that I can in this office, help bring faith and confidence back in the institution of government. That's why I'm running.